Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the If I Had One Wish podcast. I'm Crystal Hicks, and today my co-host is Tracy. Tracy, come on in and tell all our listeners who you are.
Hello, everybody. It's lovely to be here. I am privileged to be the current president and chair of Wish. I've been working in housing since 2015 when I had my first client. I came to housing because of its purpose-driven, it has a social impact, and it's also commercial. I love that mix, that blend. So I predominantly work in leadership development as an associate for Campbell Tickell and also under my own brand, which is Curious Mind. And it's such a privilege to be here speaking to Jill.
Thank you, Tracy. So I am delighted to introduce a fellow Northerner to the If I Had One Wish podcast today, the one and only Jill Murray, although I think you need little introduction. So Jill is a good friend, although we support different football teams. Jill, you have worked in the social housing sector for such a long time, and you're currently the chief exec of Launchpad, a charity working to support veterans experiencing homelessness. You're the immediate past president of the Chartered Institute of Housing, where your Be Epic campaign challenged us to be educated, professional, in control, and Chartered Institute of Housing. I had the privilege to come along to your presidential dinner where you launched your campaign, and we were joined by the leader of the opposition at that time, Sir Keir Starmer. So you really do know how to do things in style. A previous Housing Association chief executive, you are a true example of someone who's progressed from doing the post, filing, making the tea in a local authority housing department, and then taking on roles in housing management and completing your qualifications to then become one of the sector's best leaders. So you're a long-standing Sunderland Football Club fan, and I hear that you don't get much time to go along to matches these days because you spend a lot of your time living in the Lake District with your husband John, who is a lawyer and a judge. We know that you enjoy walking because of the challenge that you did for your presidential campaign, cycling as well, and I hear you're going to take up canoeing if time allows in the beautiful National Park. So it's so wonderful to have you with us today, Jill.
Thank you, Crystal. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you. So Jill, let's just get into it. Tell us about how you came to work in housing.
I started in housing in 1981. It's a long time ago, 43 years ago, 44 this year in October. I was 16 years of age and I'd just left school. I didn't really want to leave school. I would have preferred to stay on with my peers. And I did feel a little bit abandoned because I had to leave school. I didn't have any choice, mainly due to the fact that I lived with my sister. So I was orphaned when I was only 13 years of age, and my 21-year-old sister took me in, and I used to have to work in a hairdresser's shop on a Saturday in order to pay for my clothes and makeup because her and her husband sadly couldn't afford really to keep a teenage girl who was I suppose, experiencing growing up without her parents, and never mind all of the other challenges that teenagers have. The careers offers, having took 9 O-levels at school, sent me for an interview at the Civic Centre in Sunderland, the housing department, and wasn't something I'd aspired to do, but my family really pushed me in that direction because they seen working in the local authority as a job for life, the one that pays good pension, and something that you could extend or develop your career in. So they pushed me to go for an interview. Luckily, my first boss was a legend of his time, Peter Walls, and he liked people who were a bit different and described me as a cross between Pocahontas and Susie Sue from the Banshees. I was a little bit outlandish because I worked in a hairdresser's shop, so experimenting was probably where I was at the time. I think my hair was maroon and spiky on the top, long at the back and a long fringe, but other than that, pretty much shaved to my head. So a bit different, I suppose, from the rest of the candidates straight away. But also because I'd worked in a hairdresser's, I did have the ability and understanding of customer care, and that was important. I had the confidence to be able to talk to older people. Again, that'll have been important, and something that a lot of kids at 16 years old would probably not have had the experience of. For me, I would have at that time probably wanted to do something more creative because that's where my preferences lie, being creative. And this job paid a lot of money. If I stayed in a hairdresser's shop, as an example, I would have got £29 a week, £30 or something like that. But if I went into housing, it was £44.50 a week. So even then, housing paid a good salary. And I'm not going to lie, that was the reason I went into housing, because making the tea, doing the filing and the post wasn't something I aspired to do. I used to dream, always dream as a child. I read lots of books and I would just literally have a mind that dreamed constantly about what I was going to do and how I was going to do that. And always, as a child, very visionary, very creative. I would say a natural leadership skills, because I would, during the summer holidays, design events for other kids to do with us, whether that was jumble sales for charity or whether it was jazz band carnivals and things like that. So that was where I would have preferred to have went, but housing was where I started. And it wasn't until I actually got into housing that I started realising there was a lot more to it. And that I could, by reading Inside Housing as an example, which is the magazine I used to take around to the executive team as they crossed the name off the top, because there was one magazine per department pretty much. I would read that magazine and think, well, how can I get more involved? How can I do something different? And how can I be creative within this sector? So at a very early age, I didn't really have aspirations of being in housing. But once I got in there, I saw the opportunity and that was massive.
Thanks, Jill. I mean, you've gone on from working in that local authority housing department to hold some pretty impressive roles, you know, president of the Chartered Institute of Housing and a chief exec. I'd love to hear a little bit from you about sort of the challenges you faced as a woman when you came into the sector and any of those continuing challenges as you've progressed throughout your career.
Yeah. I never really saw it as a challenge until I looked back retrospectively, because I was always taught by my mum, who was widowed when I was just 11 months old and she had four young children under the age of 9 at that time, that opportunities don't happen, you have to make them happen. So if you want something, you've got to think about how am I going to achieve it and then work out a way to get there, Jill. And she would stand us in front of the mirror in the bedroom as the youngest of the four and say, you will be somebody, you know, you will. You'll be able to achieve anything you want, because no matter what tasks I give you, you're always achieving. And that might have been just supporting her. She did a lot of charity work with making things for jumble sales, or going knocking on doors and asking people if they had any jumble that I could sell in the sales, and again, to donate the money to different charities. So I was always quite entrepreneurial in that respect, whether I had to make things myself or whether I had to go and find them from other people and ask for them. And therefore, when I came into the sector, I never really saw barriers. I only ever saw opportunities. Only looking back retrospectively, I saw the barriers and some funny things that happened to us along the way, because I'm one of these people who perhaps is very open and transparent, and I just swing from the hip in terms of communications. I've had to learn how to better manage that as I got older and be more diplomatic, because it didn't really fit with what was a conservative with a small c office structure, culture. And that was quite male dominated. Although there was a lot of women in there, it was a very male dominated department in terms of senior executives, etc. And that was interesting, very interesting. But working my way up the career ladder, and certainly in terms of breaking through the glass ceiling, that's when I saw the big barriers for women. I was told, having had interviews and been the best at a certain level, trying to get to area housing manager level as an example, and the committees would be made up of councillors, mainly men, and some executive team members from the department. And I remember one set of feedback that I got was, you gave the best interview, Jill. You've got the best performance results as an assistant area manager. He gave a brilliant presentation, but we went with such and such because we thought he'd be a safer pair of hands. And that was a man who was lovely, really nice man. But yeah, he wasn't going to set the world on fire. And I just then started wondering what this is all about. I had a suspicion it was because he was a Freemason, and probably was. But I then realised that this was about, I'm a woman, I'm of a childbearing age, maybe that might be a barrier too. And I'd never really recognised it before. Anyway, I think I created as much noise as I possibly could about that and wanted to know exactly what the difference was between appointing him and appointing me. And when the next round of area managers came up, I actually was successful in that post because I made sure that I was very well prepared, that I was practiced in my presentation, and that there was nothing that they could possibly say that I wasn't good enough for. And if they come back with he was a safer pair of hands again, I probably would have just killed them. But no, seriously. Yeah, I had a challenge from day one on things like that. So breaking through that glass ceiling, I did recognise safer pair of hands. What's that mean then? You know, maybe that was about my personality, but they didn't say it was. So I think it was just one of those generic excuses for not giving us the job and giving it to a man, maybe.
Yes.
Nevertheless, the next time when that job came up and when I was successful, the job was a really nice area where everybody wanted to live, social housing wise. And I was thinking, champion, this is going to be like a breeze, this job for me. But because that was where the vacancy was. But when they offered us the job, they didn't offer us that job. They moved someone out of another part of the city, which was the biggest area of the city. It had 6,800 properties, I think, at the time. A coalfield area and really challenging because it had had no modernisation of properties that it should have had because we just didn't have the money as a council. And that's where I went and I loved it because that in itself presented a challenge and I love a challenge. So there we are, all good things. It gave us the chance to be more creative in my approach when you're put in challenging areas and to bring everybody along with you. So when I took that position, an important course that I asked for then was leadership. I'd done management development. I enjoyed that. But I asked to go on a leadership development course and they put me on one with Sunderland University and it was brilliant. For me, that was transformational, the leadership course. Really, really. Then it was the first time that I'd come across Myers-Briggs and I got to understand myself, my preferences and why. It was as if it was a light bulb moment. And I would encourage anybody to do leadership development because for me, that was a real crossroads for how I moved on from getting to that senior management position to become the person that I was going to be in the future. Always having that learning curiosity, but that was really, really emphasised at the time that I did the leadership development course with Sunderland University.
That's a lovely segue into a question that I've got for you, Jill, around your Be Epic campaign. So, you know, talking about professionalism, that Be Epic has set the standard for being a housing professional. So what do you think the legacy of the campaign has been and where do you think we need to go from here?
The legacy of the campaign itself, I think it'll be hard to benchmark because it's not as if you're going to put a questionnaire out saying, did Jill's Be Epic campaign make a difference to you? For me, it was personally about being able to tell my story that no matter where you come from, home is the place where everything begins. I didn't have a home. I was lost. And when my sister gave us a home, I was able to then put down foundations and think about the rest of my life again. And to go from that 13-year-old, totally lost kid that I was, angry with the world, to be able to get to the top of my profession and do the work that I wanted to do in changing people's lives positively by doing a job was just phenomenal. And Be Epic really has been my modus operandi, if you like, since the get-go, although informally and not knowing that until later years, because a great person who I work with and a mentor for me once said, confidence comes from competence. And I would say that is true for everyone. If you have that competence by making sure you don't just have your time in the role and experience, but you back that up with continuous learning and development of your skills, that level of understanding about yourself, your preferences, your subconscious, and then where you fit in a team, then you have the unique combination for success. You put that together with that in control bit. So you've got the professional side of that and the educated side of that. You put that with your in control, which is actually about what do I enjoy doing and how do I make the most of that? How do I make the most of the rest of my life if I'm going to spend a lot of time working, which I will have to do, whether I want to give my family the best opportunity and start in life, or whether I want to achieve anything personally in terms of where I live, what type of car I have, what type of lifestyle I have, then that is all obviously segued into the job that you do and the level of role that you have. And for me, that was my modus operandi, as I said, by being in control of that and determining where I want to be and how I'm going to get there. And because I wanted to stay in housing, I loved housing no matter what job. Being a housing officer for me was the best job I ever had. Working with people face to face, talking to them, sometimes learning about their problems and either signposting them or trying to help them. It was a bit of informal coaching, really, I think, as a neighbourhood housing officer, whether you're dealing with arrears or transfers for people who want to move, or you're dealing with homeless people, you know. It's a really broad spectrum of work that we do in housing, and that's so enjoyable because no matter what type of person you are, there's something for you in the sector and as a career. So, yeah, for me, the in control bit was about who am I, where do I want to be, and how do I get there? And then the Chartered Institute of Housing was my touchstone throughout that. Joining the professional body as a student, going and listening to people, older people, more experienced people, better qualified people, people from different sectors coming to talk to us. I could take their advice, assistance, the networking, and use that as part of my everyday work in order to progress myself, people who worked with us and for me, and also for my tenants and residents as well, learning about best practice. So that be educated, be professional, be in control, and then be Chartered Institute of Housing, for me, naturally gave us that be a big acronym. But I think it worked really well to say to people, make this your pole star, because if you get this right, there's nothing going to stop you.
Yeah, I was so inspired by your campaign, Jill. I came along to quite a few of the events where you spoke about your own story and the foundations that maybe had laid for the campaign, and it was very inspiring for me as a woman working in the sector who really wants to use my platform and my voice to influence positive change. So I'm really keen to dig into that a little bit more in terms of, you know, you have had the opportunity to campaign as part of being a president, but I know that you have other, you know, causes that you champion positive change around. And what advice would you give to women working in the sector now who really want to influence positive change?
Confidence comes from competence, I would say. You know, that lifelong learning, there's always something to learn, even at my age. You know, I'm still learning now, hence working for this incredible, amazing charity that I'm working for. I'm learning about veterans, about the armed forces sector. And I think for any young women coming into the role, I would say become a member of the Chartered Institute of Housing, further your education and qualifications, and have a learning curiosity, because there's something interesting in everyone. So even if you're learning off people and not necessarily academically, there's something interesting to be learnt. And when you work in housing, that comes in all different shapes and forms. But to just keep on going, your confidence will grow as you get more experience and your learning becomes more advanced. The world's your oyster, pretty much. There's nothing that you can't achieve. If I was to give my life again, would I come back into housing with a choice and with knowing everything I know now? Yes, I think I probably would. Would I do anything different? I'm sure there'll be things I would do differently, but maybe it was the mistakes I made along the way that made us the person that I am now. So we're all human, and sometimes we will drop the ball. So don't beat yourself up when you make mistakes. Don't beat yourself up when you don't get jobs that you want. Dust yourself down and go again.
Brilliant advice. Thank you, Jill.
So you talked a little bit about Launchpad. So can you talk to us a little bit more about the work you're doing at Launchpad and maybe around some of the challenges that you think needs to, what the change needs to be to end homelessness for veterans?
Yeah, great. I mean, as I said, I always look for a learning opportunity. I had retired and I took on the presidency, which was great. It was a learning opportunity. I had the privilege and the pleasure to go and work around the United Kingdom, looking at different homeless accommodation, talking to housing professionals on the front line, learning about their challenges now and the work that we're doing in all of the devolved nations, which was fantastic. So what next? Well, this charity is really, really special. For one, it was my idea. Like back in 2012, when I was to become the chief executive of the stock transfer of the Grade 2 star listed bike estate in Newcastle, we had a sheltered housing scheme that wasn't really being used for older people because it wasn't in the best location and because of the challenges that biker had at the time. And I thought this is an ideal scheme for veterans. I'd worked with the veteran sector throughout my career, even when I've done a short spell, 3.5 years in the private sector. Why? Well, because my granddad was a World War II veteran. My mum and my dad were both veterans themselves and did national service. My mum was a nurse and my dad in the medical corps. And so I've always had an interest in veterans and in the armed forces because these were photographs that I saw on the sideboard growing up, if you like, in my nana's house and in my own house to a degree. And therefore, veterans is something I've always been interested in. Set this charity up with the chief executive of the charity who was moving on to different things and therefore had said, look, Jill, we need someone to take over this charity. Give us an opportunity of a part-time role and a learning opportunity as well. This was a fantastic charity. The work that they do with veterans is just second to none. Homeless veterans who, like lots of homeless people, present with complex needs. But for veterans, it's different. I mean, these are the people who keep our country safe as we sleep peacefully on an evening. You know, they sometimes get forgot about. Maybe bring up when it's Remembrance Day and we think about them and we'll buy a poppy, or when there's war-torn situations that we see on the news and on the media. But every day of the year, these people work for us, keeping our security safe and keeping all of the things we take for granted intact. These are people who give their lives literally for us and are prepared to put their lives on the line, notwithstanding everything else that they do. So when they come back from serving in the armed forces from war-torn situations, because they either have to stand down or they choose to stand down, we should be looking after them, yeah? And everybody loves veterans, let's face it, because we know what they do for us, and without them, where would we be? But they don't get any preference over others. And by the way, they don't want any preference. They don't want any additional priority over other homeless groups. But they do need to be treated fairly. And in all honesty, they don't mainstream. By virtue of the fact to be a soldier or whatever position rank you might have in the armed forces, you are programmed to do a job. And you do that as a team. You literally soldier on. And admitting vulnerabilities isn't something that would come naturally because it isn't in your mindset. So generally, armed forces veterans and families of armed forces veterans are, I guess, in some way at a disadvantage just from that respect altogether. And when you put that into a single man's situation, then there's no way they're going to present themselves as vulnerable, very rarely. And they will have lots of different issues. The homeless veterans are a minority. They're not all of the armed forces. Most people transition quite normally back into civilian life. These are just the people who slip through the net. And often they'll come with complex mental health issues. And PTSD will be one of those. So one, they won't mainstream. Two, our mainstream services can't deal with that. They can't deal with them multiple complex issues in mental health anyway, whether that's mental health plus drug and alcohol or one of those abuse problems plus PTSD. They will be siloed into, well, we'll deal with your mental health. You'll have to see someone else about your drug or alcohol, and your PTSD is very specialist. You'll have to see someone else. And when really it's all one and the same thing, or can be. So for homelessness, and what the work our charity does is fantastic. It's really unique. It's one of its own in the country. It doesn't rely upon support and people funding. It gets great funding through housing benefit, through local authorities, rent and service charges, but also through the armed forces charities. And we live pretty much hand to mouth because we have to provide a lot of wraparound services, such as independent living support, education, training and activities, coordinating, you know, just getting people up to that confidence level, that capacity level, that insight of where am I and how do I get back to where I need to be, and more importantly, psychotherapy, because our psychotherapists work with us in the schemes where people get access to them immediately, that they will accept that and want that, because there has to be some buy-in, and that they can deal with all of those wraparound support issues, and this is key. So the answer for that is a bit like other homeless situations, there is a lack of move-on accommodation as well. A lack of support accommodation that understands veterans and a lack of move-on accommodation. So we do need more social housing in order for that to be an easier move from our supported accommodation. And we do float and support into independent living as well. So we'll stay with them for as long as they need us pretty much. But there's a lack of move-on accommodation, affordable move-on accommodation for veterans, which is no different to other homeless services. And for me, I think that every local authority should have a strategy for veterans housing. As I said, not giving them any more priority, but to be part of that strategy, because they are a specialist group, they won't mainstream, and that I think veterans deserve that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's, you know, every time I talk to anybody who knows anything about homelessness, Jill, we always come back to this thing of like responses need to be trauma informed and psychologically informed. It's no good taking this one size fits all approach to these solutions. And yes, it's more intensive at the front end, you know, having to develop these strategies and policies that are going to suit individuals and individual needs, but then in the longer term when you actually have some positive outcomes instead of this just merry-go-round.
The payback's massive.
Yeah.
Costs us about £19,000 a year. And on average, and I'm saying on average because everybody's different, it takes about 12 months to get people back on their feet, but contributing back to civilian life in a job or in full-time education. So all of the time, this is not costing for bed and breakfast accommodation in homelessness. This is not costing the NHS any additional money. It's not costing prison or police services or probation services. So, you know, that this is about people then making a contribution back into society. So for me, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah. So, Jill, your contribution into society is pretty phenomenal. You told me a little while ago that you'd retired, but you haven't. You're as busy as ever. What's next for you, Jill? Is it really retirement? Or will you still be with us for a little bit?
It's retirement for sure. I mean, this was too good to miss because I really believe in the work that this charity does, and it's a learning opportunity, as I said. And last year, I did a comedy course because it was a learning opportunity, not because I wanted to be a comedian at all. In fact, my husband challenged me because he said, you've got a really literal sense of humour, so you don't really have a normal sense of humour, Jill. But it wasn't because of that. It was about how do you engage audiences better? How do you get your story across better? How do you get people to believe in what you're telling them and to engage in that emotionally? And that was really good. A comedy course, would you believe it, in Newcastle. It was fantastic. And Alfie Joy, who run the course, was brilliant. So for me, yeah, I want to get back to retirement after I've helped this charity get back on its feet and then get back to seeing more football and spending more time with my grandchildren, who I absolutely adore.
They've absolutely earned it.
Lovely. So we always have this question at the end of the podcast. Of course we do. So the final question is, if you had one wish for the sector, what would it be and why?
Ah, for the sector. I wrote three answers to this question because if it was for me, it would be Sunderland Football Club back in the Premiership, starting with a win against Leeds tonight.
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah. But for the sector, I think it's rent convergence is a practical solution to that. Because when I was a chief executive, we were on our way to converging our rents. This is about everybody on a level playing field rather than putting rents up for the sake of it. And it means that if we go back to rent convergence, that we can get rents, everybody's rent, whether you're a housing association or a local authority, back at the same level from an affordable housing perspective, because some rents are still much lower than properties that are along the street, which is madness, really. And that allows us then to maximise that capital revenue money and to build more houses, which is where we need to be as a sector. I hear from fellow chief executives the massive challenge that they've got now with zero carbon priorities, with health and safety and fire safety costs additional that have come in. And these are not just threefold. These have sometimes gone up by 14 times the amount that they were paying maybe 10 years ago, just for compliance. So having rent conversions would certainly help the sector. I think it's a common sense way of getting everybody on a level playing field, and then whatever inflationary rises come after that. But ultimately, this is what's going to determine that we build more social housing or not, because the money isn't going to come from thin air. It certainly isn't going to come from the government, because they don't have it. and they're trying to prioritise other things like the National Health Service, etc. And finally, for me, I think it would be on a much more global scale, peace. Peace within the world. So Sunderland in the Premiership, rent conversions for the sector, and peace, even if it's just for one day.
Oh, thank you, Jill.
What do you think's most likely to happen?
Sunderland in the Premiership. Yes, come on.
We normally only let you have one wish, but your wishes were so specific that you're allowed to have the three. That's fine.
Rent conversions could happen because, you know, it makes sense.
It does.
Isn't a lot of money that, I mean, they've made more available, capital available for new homes, but it's never going to be able to deliver their 1.5 million target. So rent conversions to me is sensible. The last government, as we know, scrapped that, which was madness because some housing associations were, especially the stock transfer ones, were like maybe half midway through making that rent conversions happening. That had a massive impact on their business plans. And when they're sitting there with land development sites that are ready to be developed, that little bit extra income will support that.
And let's hope that the powers that be are listening. We're always here to offer advice. So thank you so much, Jill, for joining us on today's podcast. It's been a pleasure to speak to you and to learn more about your story. And thank you, Tracy, for being my co-host. It's been a pleasure. You've been listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast. Next time, we'll be talking to another inspirational female from the housing sector. He will be sharing her career story and what she's learned along the way. And of course, we'll be asking again the big question. If she had one wish, what would it be and why? See you next time.